Next, I go to seven gates, each step less a mystery. By Shaney. Read by Petica. Part 2 of the Don't Look Too Closely, All Angles Are Oblique series. Summary. The truth is, he can't wait to see Tony again. Even more truthful, he's fiercely hopeful that Tony is still interested in their half-engineered agreement. Tony sounds like it, but he tries to keep his expectations low. Nobody has to tell him that Tony Stark can be fickle. It doesn't change the fact that he craves Tony's touch, even after having it just that once. And he doesn't see any reason not to take what Tony is offering, as long as Steve doesn't forget exactly what this is. 1. Steve spends 3 days with contract specialists at S.H.I.E.L.D., going over notes Tony had made to the contracts he'd signed. The amount of money these contracts are worth is absolutely staggering. And Steve reminds himself ruefully that whatever else happens, he probably doesn't actually have to barter for contracts with his body. New contracts are printed with Tony's stipulations added, and both the Army and S.H.I.E.L.D. spend 2 days doing nothing but pestering Steve for ideas. They haven't missed the fact that most of the things Tony had signed had been things Steve had suggested in the first place. It sends Steve into a 3-day, deeply analytical study of the conflicts in the Middle East. He had known most of it already, but only in general terms. He's put in touch with colonels on battlefields, warrant officers, the people who really know what they need and what they want, and the occasional thing that they'd do anything for. Steve is familiar enough with war to be able to guess most of what might work, but the terrain is different, and the guerrilla fighting style that seems to prevail requires a rethink of what might work and how. He has no idea when he might see Tony again. He thinks that either Tony or Fury will call, but he's decided that if it doesn't happen in the next few days, Steve is going to make the call himself, with full understanding of what he's doing and why. He jerks off every night, sometimes just once before crashing into sleep, sometimes as many times as his body will let him, figuring out how to finger himself. Not anything close to as good as Tony doing it. And he thinks the whole time. He remembers. He imagines. Probably also not close to as good as what Tony could imagine. Until he collapses, shuddering with raw pleasure and exhaustion, and waits for his knees to be steady enough to clean himself up. Then he gets up again and spends the day trying to convey the kinds of things he thinks will be effective in the field to people that don't have any idea what it's like to be in the field. 2. When he can't stand it another day, he snags a sketch pad and makes his way down into the city, where he walks until he finds a cafe with a view he likes, and just spends the day putting what he sees with his eyes down on paper. Even then, his attention flags towards early afternoon, and he finds himself outlining a drawing of Tony, with heavy eyes and the bare suggestion of a smile. Just seeing it makes his body respond, and he closes the sketch pad without finishing it. He buys 3 hot dogs from a vendor, wanders around a little more until he's got his bearings, and then sets off towards home. His phone rings in his pocket while he's still a few blocks away. Steve considers not answering it. He can't get used to the way people talk on their phones in public. It seems unbearably rude. But he checks to see who's calling, because it could be important. It's Tony. Honestly, if it had been anyone else, Steve probably would have waited until he was home and called them back. But instead, he ducks into a less populous side street and answers. Steve Rogers speaking.
I was at your apartment today, Tony says without preamble. Good lighting, a decent place. A little old-fashioned in the decorating department, but I can see how you might like the clean lines of it.
It came decorated, Steve says. He's torn between asking how Tony had gotten into Steve's apartment and asking why he felt the need to do so. Before he can, Tony continues.
Of course, there was no you in it, so that kind of defeated most of the purpose.
That's either sweet or utterly self-involved. Steve thinks that Tony might actually have the ability to be both at the same time. Why did you visit? Steve asks calmly, though he's actually a little alarmed. There isn't anything in the apartment that would give him away, except for the shield, of course. Steve had insisted. And though the shield is in a concealed line safe in the floor of the bedroom, all the way under the bed, he doesn't doubt that if Tony had been looking for something specifically, he would have found it, and would have likely made short work of the security involved.
I wanted to see where you lived,
Tony says.
I wanted to see if you were home.
He sounds like he's ticking things off on his fingers.
I wanted to take you out to dinner. I wanted to offer you an executive suite in the tower if you wanted it. But mostly, I wanted to fuck you.
Steve is surprised into a chuckle. I don't want an executive suite in the tower, he says, smiling.
Ah, but you didn't mention how you feel about dinner and fucking.
Tony sounds triumphant. Steve can hear him grinning. I just ate dinner, Steve says. Are you still at my apartment?
No,
Tony says, sounding just a little bit disappointed.
Is that a deal breaker? Because I'm pretty sure I can get back there in half an hour, 40 minutes tops.
What are you doing now? Steve asks, suspicious.
There's a thing. A charity thing. I'll write them a huge check. They won't miss me at all.
Now Tony sounds a little whiny, and Steve has to bite back another chuckle. No, Steve says. I only know Miss Potts by reputation, but I don't want to get on her bad side before I even meet her. But I've got some paperwork for you, some contracts. But some of it's just ideas that I had that I need your scientific background to really work through.
You've got all the Army and SHIELD scientists to ping ideas off of,
Tony says, but he sounds pleased anyway. And I have, Steve says, but I don't think they're getting me. I don't know if it's because I don't quite grasp the jargon, or if it's because they have a very limited understanding of what war is actually like. He pauses, then softens his tone. I think you'd be better.
And then you'll let me take you to dinner?
Tony asks expectantly. Steve feels himself flushing. Yes, then you can take me to dinner. What time do you want me? There's a long pause that Steve can only speculate about. When Tony finally answers, his voice is low.
I'll clear my afternoon, eat an early lunch, show up at 1:30.
Steve's belly dips at receiving such an explicit instruction, but he keeps his breathing steady. The truth is, he can't wait to see Tony again. Even more truthful, he's fiercely hopeful that Tony is still interested in their half-engineered agreement. Tony sounds like it, what with the visit to Steve's apartment and the tone of his voice. But he tries to keep his expectations low. Nobody has to tell him that Tony Stark can be fickle. It doesn't change the fact that he craves Tony's touch, even after having it just that once. And he doesn't see any reason not to take what Tony is offering, as long as Steve doesn't forget exactly what that is. I'll be there, Steve says.
Bring a suit,
Tony says. I don't have a suit, Steve replies. I've got 4 dress uniforms, 3 pairs of jeans, 4 t-shirts, and 6 pairs of socks and underwear. I'm supposed to be getting some BDUs, but they haven't come in yet. Tony huffs.
Are you home yet?
Close by, Steve says.
Great. Keep walking north past your apartment. Take the first left onto Salento. And go into the shop 3 doors down. Ask for Oldham, and tell him to put it on my account. Tell him I'm going classic black, and to give you something dashing. Tony's voice is abruptly tinny, which Steve suspects means he's texting on his phone while he has Steve on speaker. He's gotten better with the phone, even without Tony's tutelage. There's a girl that frequents the same coffee shop that gives him morning lessons in exchange for coffee. Steve is kind of proud of his own bartering abilities in that particular case.
No, never mind. Already done. He's expecting you. And he's kind of cranky, so you might want to hurry.
You don't have to, Steve tries to say, but Tony interrupts.
And we're here. No more time to talk. Don't avoid your appointment, or I'll just send someone to your place for measurements. In which case, I'll make sure you end up with a baker's dozen suits, plus a tuxedo. Don't argue. I'll just keep making it worse.
Steve sighs. All right. I'll go straight there. Have fun at the charity thing. Tony grumbles something Steve doesn't quite catch, and then adds,
I'd rather be at dinner with you.
It catches Steve by surprise. Not, I'd rather be fucking you, but, I'd rather be at dinner with you. Of course, it probably all functions as one continuous act in Tony's mind. Still, Steve smiles. Yeah, well, I don't want you to buy me a suit either, so we can't always get what we want. Tony humphs.
Tomorrow, Tony says. Eat lightly, at least an hour before you show up.
Okay, Steve says, no real idea of why, but willing to humor Tony. Good night, Tony. He hangs up first. He suspects that Tony either gets bored of conversations and hangs up on people, or lingers on the line so he's sure that he hangs up last. 3. Tony hadn't arranged for one or even two suits. He'd arranged for 5. They measure Steve in every conceivable way, fit him from the rack. Mr. Oldham seems unhappy about that, but Steve tries to explain that it's an emergency, and then pin him up so expeditiously that Steve is a little worried about bleeding on his new suit. Tomorrow morning, Oldham tells Steve as he urges Steve towards the door. We deliver the emergency suit. He fills the word with disdain. The others bespoke. No argue. He holds up a finger in front of Steve's face, and Steve closes his mouth. Mr. Stark left instructions. The rest we will deliver in a few days. Okay, Steve says, because he's honestly not sure what else to say. Clearly this guy is all the way on Tony's team. It seems unlikely that Steve is going to be able to talk him out of it. Oldham pats his cheek. You nice boy. Maybe keep Mr. Stark behaving. Steve blinks, and by the time he has, Oldham has disappeared back into his shop. Steve snorts. He doesn't anticipate having any control at all over Tony Stark behaving. Steve runs early the next morning, unable to stay asleep with what he can't really deny are nerves. He circles across Midtown and through Central Park, and he gets back a little after 9. There's a young man waiting outside his door with a garment bag and one of those computer-driven signature receiving boxes. Steve can't tell if he's been waiting long or not. His expression seems to indicate that it's all the same to him. Steve signs for his suit, and, because he doesn't know about these things anymore, asks, Do I tip you? I'm sorry, I don't get a lot of stuff delivered, and I'm not sure of the etiquette. The young man smiles. Not delivery drivers, unless they're bringing food. Usually bellhops. Always stylists, bartenders, waiting staff, cab drivers, and hotel maids. There might be a few other oddities here and there, but that's a good rule of thumb. When in doubt, though, tip. At worst, employees that aren't allowed tips siphon them into a communal fund to put together fun activities. Steve hands him $20 anyway. It's worth it to get a primer, he tells the young man, who laughs and pockets the money. My college fund thanks you,
he tells Steve with a jaunty salute, and swings around to the stairs, headed down. Steve lets himself into the apartment, hangs the suit without looking into the bag, and then takes a shower long enough and hot enough to leave him pink-skinned and relaxed. He makes himself a sandwich at a little after 11 and eats it with a glass of lemonade. And he doesn't realize he's trying not to think about what may or may not happen with Tony today until he finds himself facing the closet, trying to decide if he ought to wear the suit or wear his uniform and bring the suit along. Steve has a list. It was mostly scribbled down on the back of an envelope from Steve's electric bill on the night he'd come home from Stark Tower with a sore ass and still sporting at least a partial erection. Most of them are things he definitely wants. A few of them, added later, when he'd had some distance, had to do with what he might want that doesn't necessarily include sex. Not that some of them couldn't, just that they weren't necessarily about sex. The list isn't really in any kind of exact order, and Steve hasn't made any effort to rearrange it, in the same way that he hasn't made any effort to research the books and computer sites that Tony had offered. It was about Tony's face when he'd said that he wouldn't mind teaching Steve, that the idea had its charm. A thing that Steve can picture Tony saying carelessly, laughingly, but which hadn't been like that at all. It had been more like Tony offering Steve something that Tony had been surprised to realize he might want too. Part of Steve's decision is based on the simple fact that being in Tony's power had been good, even when he hadn't known why. Maybe even especially when he hadn't known why. Maybe, if he's truthful, even if he still can't pinpoint why. It's good for him. That's what he knows. And that's enough for him to know. The rest is based off a kind of intuitive understanding of the kind of man Tony is. Something pieced together from their encounter, but also through his files and his public image. Which is to say, Steve suspects that the teaching might slow Tony down enough for Steve to keep up with him. That there is a difference between wanting someone with a specific skill set and wanting to help a man define a certain skill set. Maybe that is more personal to Steve than it would ever be to Tony, but he isn't willing to change his mind because of that. There are obviously things Steve doesn't know and cannot guess. Alternative lifestyles, one of Tony's book suggestions had been titled. And Steve is clearly at least passingly interested in some of them. Whether it's personal for Tony or not, it's personal for Steve, and he wants Tony to be the one to help him explore those parts of himself. Tony is experienced at this, and a genius. And the idea of asking anyone else, Steve can never risk it. Someday, someone is going to connect Captain America to Steve Rogers again, and the possibility of exposure makes any other method absolutely unacceptable. Tony is his only resource for this, and, Steve has to admit, the only resource he wants. Steve knows that's a dangerous way to feel. He shakes his head. Never mind that now. He opens the garment bag and looks inside. The suit is dark blue, with a shimmery kind of texture to the fabric. It includes a tie and a pocket square that match, both of a much lighter blue, and the shirt is cream-colored. Steve is a little relieved. He hadn't really been worried that Tony would pick out something outlandish for him, but it's hard to guess what Tony is going to do. He zips the bag back up. He'll take it with him. He thinks it's better to dress consistently when he visits Tony's office. And since he's normally there as a liaison, the uniform is the way to go. He dresses, hands on automatic, aware of his cock not quite hard in his uniform pants, but not quite soft either. He soothes himself with buttons and clasps. He'd made sure to have his ribbons corrected, so they aren't posthumous, at least, but there are still too many of them for Steve's comfort. He still has half an hour before he even needs to leave, and he scoops up the sketch pad, turning to the unfinished picture of Tony, and does some filling in, shading, lightening his face a little in a way that makes his eyes all the darker. He tucks it into his desk drawer and locks it, not quite sure why, but trusts enough in the instinct to do it anyway. 4. There is a blonde behind the desk when Steve shows up this time. She smiles, more bright and friendly than possessive, and Steve can't help being a little relieved, and says, "Captain Rogers, I presume?" Steve nods and fishes out his ID. She glances carelessly at it and passes him a slim, slick keycard. "You've been approved for all levels of the tower. This card specifically will allow you to use Mr. Stark's private elevator." She gestures to it. It's half hidden behind her desk and a potted plant. "It's also a keycard for some of the high-security areas. Some of them it won't work on." She shoots him a grin. "Mr. Stark doesn't want anyone wandering into dangerous areas without intent." She glances down at her desk. "You're his only appointment for the rest of the day, which means I can leave as soon as you feel confident that you know where you're going. Is there something I can help with?" "Is Tony in his office?" Steve asks, not liking the idea of wandering around the tower searching for him. "He is expecting you there," she tells him, and eyes the briefcase in Steve's hand. "Looks like a long night. Make him order something in if you can't distract him enough to take a break for real food." Steve smiles. "I'll see if I can keep him on task as much as possible." She smiles with dimples. "We all do what we can," she says sympathetically. Steve can tell she's ready to go home, and likes her better for her easy manner and sweet smile, which seems to do nothing but wish Steve well. Since she's pointed out the elevator, Steve decides to try it out. He figures out how to swipe the card, and the doors immediately open. He pushes the button for the 85th floor, and the doors slide close again at once. It's small, though not claustrophobic, and smells strongly of Tony inside. Steve shifts his collar and tries to pretend the scent doesn't firm him up in his pants. This elevator is extremely fast, at least compared to the other one. He arrives on the 85th floor at least 30 seconds faster this time. The hall it opens on is nothing like the plain, gravity-ridden corridor from the other elevator. This one has soft music playing, some kind of jazz that Steve can almost recognize. And there are tables with plants and benches and a mini wet bar between two wingback chairs. The door to Tony's office is different, too. He shouldn't be surprised. Though Tony's office had been enormous, it couldn't have been big enough to fill more than half the floor. A second, more private office makes sense. The door is merely carved maple, and Steve knocks on it softly. He's sure Jarvis will announce his presence if he's not loud enough. A moment later, the door swings open, and Tony stands smirking at Steve. He's holding a glass, which he immediately shoves into Steve's hand, at the same time that he relieves Steve of his suit and hangs it on the garment rack. Steve sips at warm, smoky bourbon, and makes a sound of approval that makes Tony spin and beam at him. Tony makes no bones about looking Steve over this time, though he hadn't actually been subtle the last time either. This is different, though. This is the look you give someone when you expect something to come in. Steve smiles a little bashfully, but lets Tony tug him by the arm into a wood-paneled room with a smaller version of Tony's other desk, another something computer-like up against one wall, and four doors leading into areas that Steve can't clearly see. There's a couch up against one wall, one that looks long enough for even Steve to stretch out on. And Tony is sans jacket, his sleeves rolled up over his forearms. "Just, can you give me a minute?" he asks, brow a little furrowed. "Of course," Steve says, and watches with real intent as Tony goes back to the computer thing and begins manipulating it with his fingertips, brushing aside little light displays that look like charts and machines, pulling apart whole devices to apparently look inside at the component pieces, and then tapping almost silently at a blue, see-through keyboard that's built into the corner at an angle. Steve knows it's holographic technology, but he's never actually seen it. He thinks it's beautiful. "Break it down all three ways, Jarvis," Tony says. "I want to see how the heat resistance and fuel tolerance stack up."
"Yes, sir. Would you like a report this evening?"
Steve could be wrong, but Jarvis sounds just a tad sly about the question.
"Ingrate," Tony mutters. "I'll ask you for it when I want it. Or if I don't, remind me before noon tomorrow."
"Indeed, sir,"
Jarvis says.
"Shall I initiate a blackout?"
Tony looks at Steve. Steve keeps his face neutral, but is pretty sure he ruins it by blushing faintly. "Yes. 3 hours, key to your name. Reservations?"
"Already handled. Plus or minus 1.5 hours acceptable at your convenience."
"Thanks, Jarvis," Tony says, looking abruptly a little tired.
"It is always a pleasure, sir,"
Jarvis says, sounding much more sincere this time. "I tell you never to build your own AI," Tony says. "But first of all, you wouldn't even know where to start. And second of all, I'm not sure how I'd get anything done without him."
"So he is an AI?" Steve asks.
He'd read the reports, but the reports didn't seem to agree. Tony looks at him sharply.
"Do I have to worry about you reporting this back to the Army or S.H.I.E.L.D.?"
Steve doesn't bother to pretend not to be hurt. "Blackout information is blacked out. It's between you and me, and it's no one else's business." Tony relaxes. He has a half glass of what looks like might be a gin and tonic, which he knocks back.
"What do you think?" he asks. "Contracts first, or put them off until last?"
"If we don't do them first, I think it's possible you'll be too drunk to do them last."
"Spoil sport," Tony says, but he gives Steve another thorough examination. "Do something for me?"
"Yes," Steve says immediately. He sees Tony pause a little at his lack of hesitation, but it barely lasts a moment. Tony grabs a large plush cushion from the couch and plops it onto the floor next to the chair in front of Tony's super hologram computer.
"Get undressed. Sit with me while I go over these so I can touch you anytime I want to."
Steve strips down with military efficiency, aware of Tony watching him, and a little embarrassed, but not enough to stop him. He waits for Tony to settle in the chair, and then brings the briefcase over and settles himself onto the cushion, which is soft and wide and pretty comfortable. Tony runs his fingers through Steve's hair once, as though to see if he can get away with it, and then takes the briefcase and keys to open it. For a long time, Tony just scans the contents, brow a little furrowed in focus. He drops a hand down to stroke Steve's chest and neck occasionally, but Steve thinks it's more a comfort thing than a sex thing. Eventually, Tony sighs. "When do you think they'll get it that even if they keep sending me the same drafts again and again, I'm not going to accidentally mess up and sign any of them?" He sounds tired. Steve eases the papers out of his hands, stacks the extraordinarily unlikely ones off to the side, and then spreads the other dozen or so across Tony's desk, leaning up to do so, his naked thigh brushing against Tony's pants. Enough of a touch to bring Steve's nudity strongly to the front of his mind. As if he knows it, Tony strokes a hand down his back and turns his face towards Steve's neck, though he doesn't do anything but breathe against Steve's throat for a few seconds. Just that is enough to make Steve feel breathless.
"Pen?" Steve asks. Tony produces one, seemingly from nowhere, and presents it to Steve. These are mostly good. The problems creep in when they try to push the purpose of the designs past what they're meant for. I saw it when they were writing them up, but I don't actually get my hands on them until they're ready for you, so I couldn't mess with them. He flips through and circles clauses, footnotes, unclear verbiage, and blatant bullshit. Tony's right hand roves lightly over the planes of his back, stopping just short of his ass. Steve tries to concentrate on the task at hand, but he's already hard. The problem is, they want to sneak weapons concessions into everything. It's like they think we can't read, Steve says irritably. Tony chuckles, his hand loosely curled around the back of Steve's neck. Steve resists the urge to lean into the warmth of Tony's body. Instead, he says, with all of this taken out, these are viable field survival tools. He's aware of Tony watching him do the same to most of the others, cutting them down to their basic forms, and he's sure Tony knows all this, could probably cut them down faster. But he isn't sure he'll bother to put in the work to correct it if Steve doesn't make the attempt. Tony says. Okay, I accept the possibilities. Research and development, at least. Though, no promises until I can build and control some working models. He tips his head at Steve. And the big one that you don't want me to look at yet? That's not it at all, Steve says softly, honestly. I want you to look at it most of all, but I want your full attention. I want to know you're listening. This is my design. Not the engineering, but the point behind it. You don't have to approve it. I understand you have limits. But listen. Tony tips forward beside him, his arm pressing against Steve's. His fingertips are resting against the inside of Steve's wrist. It's a little maddening. It looks like a helicopter, Tony says neutrally. He tips the page a little and says, Yellow Jacket, did you name that? Steve blushes but doesn't answer. It is a helicopter, Tony, but listen. And Steve takes him through it, thought by thought. It's not a combat bird. It doesn't even have armaments. It can't take more than a smattering of enemy fire without crumbling in the air. But that's not what it's for. The problem is guerrilla warfare, Steve explains. Our enemies are fighting on their home ground from positions of safety, and we're out there on the plains, targets for anyone who's looking for a target. Sometimes a whole unit of ground troops can be ambushed by less than 4 enemy troops. Individuals, I mean. Just 4. If an air troop transport goes down, things get ugly especially fast. Another troop class transport, ground or air, can't cover distances fast enough, aren't quick enough to dodge incoming fire, don't have medical supplies other than the most basic. The chance of rescue by a force of friendlies is less than the chance of rescue by nearby natives that consider themselves neutral in the conflict. Those are real statistics. I can show you the number. These, Steve says, and pulls out the engineering pages of the presentation. Their hands brush when Steve passes them over, and want seems to arc throughout Steve at Tony's casual touch. Tony isn't even looking at him, and Steve has never felt more naked. These are direct rescue vessels, he manages, dragging his hand away from Tony's. They're lightweight and faster than any other helicopter in the theater. They're classified small troop transport, so just big enough to pick up a party of 6 to 8 wounded. But they're fast. Simulations suggest they could be on the ground, with all survivors loaded, within less than 2 minutes if they're close. But even distance rescues are possible. The Yellow Jackets aren't burdened down with weaponry or armor at all. They can cover a huge amount of distance in a fraction of the time it would take for ground or air support to pull off a rescue. And if we send in a Blackhawk or a Chinook at the same time, There's a good chance that an enemy force would focus on that, and the Yellow Jackets could be loaded and out of range before air support would even have to engage. A single anti-ballistic missile would atomize it, Tony says. But he's looking at Steve seriously, not like he's just kicking down Steve's house of cards. His hand has moved up to cup Steve's neck loosely again. Steve wants to loosen the muscles of his neck and let Tony's hand support him. Instead, he forces himself a little straighter where he's kneeling. Kneeling at Tony's feet, his mind seems compelled to remind him, which doesn't help at all, and takes a steadying breath. Would add stealth modifications to existing carriers. Tony looks dubious. I know, it's not perfect, but any pilot on the ground that might have a chance at a rescue would take it in a heartbeat. I know. This gives them a chance. These birds will fly like sparrows among a flight of fat-bellied crows. And routine troop movements on the ground, or even air troops that get shot down in the desert. It's not because someone is out practicing his target shooting. At least, not most of the time. It's because the opposition doesn't want them any closer. If we can send more troops out with a more reliable method of potential rescue, we can cut down on the areas that need to be searched, at least somewhat. It's different, I know. We can't expect to find one enemy base and be done, but every one we find narrows down the list. Tony has been silent for most of Steve's speech. He glances at Tony, who is watching him. He doesn't say anything at first, but Tony's gaze ticks down his body thoughtfully, hanging for a long moment on Steve's erection. Steve's face heats, but he ignores it as much as he can. This is too important for Tony's undeniable appeal to distract Steve. At least, not any more than kneeling naked at Tony's feet already distracts him. You know Stark Industries doesn't actually make helicopters, right? Tony says. But he looks focused. Like he's thinking more about what's in his head than about what he's saying. Stark Industries doesn't make military-grade helicopters, Steve corrects. But you have at least two manufacturing facilities that make other, smaller helicopters for private and commercial use. You have the means to make helicopters. Tony blinks at him, though he looks more impressed than surprised. Why would you know that? Because I researched it when I had the idea for the Yellow Jacket, Steve says honestly. Because I knew that weapons were absolutely out of the question, and I suspected that armed and armored helicopters probably were too. But this is not a military helicopter. This is a rescue helicopter that is merely going to be utilized by the military. The design itself would work as well for any number of federal or police agencies as rescue helicopters. Hell, medical transport helicopters are slow compared to these. You can market these to the Coast Guard, Tony. I'm not an engineer, but most of the guys that helped with the designs say that it's better than what's currently in use, even on government levels. Tony regards him seriously for a long moment. Why? Our people are dying on the ground because we can't get to them. I had friends that died that way. I almost died that way. I was so lucky, it counts as miraculous. This could change that. It's not a lie. It's not even an evasion, really. The fact that it had been a different time, a different war, doesn't change that. Tony watches him for a handful of seconds with hooded eyes. Then he says, Jarvis.
Sir?
Scan these documents into the Stark mainframe. Include the systems notated to improve stealth for military aircraft I'm already working on. Pull them apart for me. I want to see if it can be done better. I want to keep the flight speed and maneuverability of the craft, but find some way to bolster its integrity. He pauses. Correction. direct documents to Captain Rogers' secure server.
Yes, sir,
Jarvis says placidly. Blackout, Jarvis, he says. He turns to Steve again. Steve doesn't know what to say. He sits still and watches Tony, until Tony tugs him bodily closer, the pillow scooting across the floor, and tucks Steve's cheek up against his thigh. Steve is glad to be there, even as he's afraid of the questions Tony will most certainly ask about his near-death experience. But Tony doesn't ask. Five. You didn't even ask me why I wanted you to undress, Tony says, after several silent seconds. It's not phrased like a question, but Steve understands that it is one, if Steve wants to answer it. You told me why, Steve says. You said you wanted to be able to touch me anytime you wanted. And that's okay with you? Tony asks, looking genuinely curious. The look erases some of the wariness from his face. Yes, Steve says honestly. And then, a little less certainly, it seemed like a comfort to you. I don't mind being a source of comfort to you. Tony shifts a little, looking down at Steve thoughtfully. What do you mind? Steve shifts uncomfortably but says, I don't know. How much of what I suggested did you actually read? Tony wants to know. His expression is strictly neutral now, and Steve doesn't especially like the way it looks on Tony. I didn't read any of it, he says, staring at his knees. Tony doesn't speak for long enough that Steve offers a little plaintively. You said you'd teach me. He can't quite manage to meet Tony's eyes, but he tips his chin up a little anyway. Do you even have any idea what you like? Tony asks, sliding a finger under Steve's chin to make him meet Tony's eyes. I like what happened last time, Steve says, flushing. I like this. This? Tony asks. I like being here, at your feet. Tony lets out a harsh breath. That's not exactly a lot to go on, Captain, he says, though he's still got a loose hand around the back of Steve's neck, along with the one tipping up his chin. The effect is enough to still Steve, make him feel a little pinned in place. He would be lying if he pretended he doesn't like the way it feels. Even less when you don't know what I like and don't like. I don't think you realize how easily I could shape you into something designed specifically for my own personal amusement. Steve has actually considered this and isn't worried. He doesn't think Tony would actually maliciously do it, first of all. But secondly, he doesn't mind the idea of being designed specifically for Tony. He doesn't say anything, and Tony blows out an impatient breath. Steve sighs a little and admits, I understand that's probably going to happen no matter what, given your experience and my lack. If we're going to have sex regularly, it only makes sense. But I don't think you'll ignore things that I might like just because you don't feel strongly about them. All right, Tony says quietly, watching Steve with interest. I think you might be granting me a larger degree of trust than I necessarily merit. But what the hell? Tell me this. Why didn't you want to find out on your own? Read it for yourself. Steve has never been a good liar. He's good at being devious on occasion, and he kind of wants to use it in this instance. It's a little embarrassing. But he also thinks there's no way to get what he wants out of this without being honest about what that is. Deception would defeat the purpose. The last time, Steve pauses and frowns. It was good. It was really good. But the beginning of it was the idea of being not controlled, but not in control either. He glances at Tony, trying to see if Tony's getting what he's saying. But Tony is still watching him expectantly. When I decided to let you just do whatever, that made it. Steve doesn't know the right word, but Tony saves him this time. Okay, I see, Tony says, and runs his fingers through Steve's hair. I get what you mean. Just give me a minute to think here. Steve waits. Tony's thigh is warm, and he smells amazing. Steve refuses to let himself be worried. Eventually, Tony says, there are things, definitions, that becoming familiar with would help you make decisions about the things I want to do to you. Do you understand? Without that baseline knowledge, you're going to have to do that a lot. Just let me do whatever, I mean. It's statistically unlikely that doing it like that will always work out for you. If I don't like it, I'll tell you to stop, Steve says, which seems to be the obvious solution. Tony's eyes crinkle a little as he smiles. What if you realize that you like telling me to stop, even when you don't actually want me to stop? Steve opens his mouth. He doesn't anticipate that being a problem, and then stops and really thinks about it. He thinks about it generally, in the sense that he might say it by accident, because he clearly babbles sometimes. Then he thinks about it specifically. What might Tony do that Steve would ask him to stop, even if he doesn't want Tony to stop? He's no stranger to rape fantasy, and he's experienced them from both perspectives. It hadn't... Well, no. Of course it hadn't occurred to him. But his cock is slicking up his thigh with pre-cum, and he can imagine clearly the point Tony is trying to make. Tony says, what you need is a safe word. It should be something you wouldn't say during sex under any circumstances, and it should be something we can both remember. Tony pauses. His gaze is dark on Steve again. Sometimes I'll want to gag you, he says, without apology. When I do that, we'll work out a way for you to tap out if things get out of control. Steve thinks about being gagged and can't quite get his head around it. He can only picture it as a wad of cloth stuffed in his mouth, with maybe another tied around his head to keep it in place. And it doesn't really provide a thrill. He's not totally against it. He's willing to let Tony do it to him if Tony likes it. And if Steve decides he hates it, he'll tap out. That part he understands. So, he says eventually, I need a safe word in case something happens I don't like. It isn't quite a question, but Tony nods anyway. Before we can do anything else. He's staring at Steve as though he knows everything Steve has been thinking. We're going to have a brief discussion about what it all means. Steve opens his mouth to object, and Tony holds up a finger. Steve considers that motion and the way that his cock responds to it, and closes his mouth. Only in the most general sense, Tony says. I get... He pauses and gazes at Steve, and Steve understands that Tony does not get why, but is willing to take Steve at his word, and Steve finds himself relaxing a little. Maybe I don't, but I accept what you want, or don't want in this case. But at least a little information is necessary. Like your safe word. We'll set that up. I'll tell you some things. And then? He pauses again. I'm going to run you through your paces, he says finally. His voice is rough enough that Steve's cock responds. He turns further towards Steve, fingers still nudging up under his chin. The loosest definition of what we're doing is just consensual kink. It's a really broad definition that can stretch anywhere from a bit of rough sex to whips and chains and blood play. He's watching Steve's face as he explains. Steve listens intently, but refuses to be cowed by the idea of whips and chains. He doesn't think he wants that, but it's clear that he doesn't know a lot of what he actually wants. So he's not ruling anything out, not even blood play, whatever that is. There are an array of acronyms I could explain, maybe even should explain, but I'll settle for the pair that most affects the two of us right now. Right now, at this very moment, we're interacting on a sub-dom basis. That means that one partner is submissive to the needs of the dominant partner. Steve blushes, but doesn't open his mouth. I like this area a lot. There's a lot of room for imagination, at the same time that it can be as simple as a situation in which I'm stressed or tired or cranky and can drag a submissive off to bed to work over until I feel better. Tony's still watching his face. Steve is trying to remain neutral. But a lot of the categories overlap, so there are a lot of things that we might do that fall into the submissive dominant range but fit better under other labels. When that happens, I'm going to want to explain where things fit. Are you getting me? Steve is trying hard not to imagine what it might feel like for Tony to drag him to bed and work him over until Tony feels better. Something about that, the phrasing of it, is lodged hotly in the pit of Steve's belly. He manages a yes, but he can feel that his face is on fire. Tony says nothing for almost a minute, and then, gently, says, "This is where you negotiate for what makes you comfortable." "I want to see you naked," Steve blurts. His face burns, but he doesn't look away from Tony. "I want to be able to touch you." Tony stares at him, a little narrow-eyed. "That's what you want to negotiate for?" he asks finally. "Nothing you want to avoid? Or ease into, or maybe skip entirely?" Steve bites his lip. "I want to do the things you want to do. I want to find out if I like them too. I don't want to rule any of it out because I'm not sure how I feel about it, or because I just don't have the experience to recognize it." "So you're comfortable in the submissive role?" Tony asks, his eyes gleaming. "Why wouldn't I be?" Steve asks. "You're clearly the one who already knows how to do everything." "That wouldn't actually stop a lot of people," Tony says wryly, but he's still watching Steve with gleaming eyes, and his expression is distantly amused, but laced faintly with what looks like avarice to Steve. Steve likes that look, even as he can feel it heating his face. "I'm not a lot of people," he says. "And if there was something you showed me that I wanted to try on you, I'd say something." "There are some things I don't let anyone do to me," Tony says, frankly, now looking a little wary. "It's nothing personal." Steve thinks it is, but doesn't say so. He thinks this is already personal to some degree. And like anything that is, sometimes that changes what a person is willing to do. What he actually says is, "I wouldn't want to do anything to you that you think you won't like." Tony looks at him knowingly, probably aware of what Steve is thinking about without saying, but it doesn't bother Steve. If you decide to have sex with a genius, he guesses you have to expect him to be able to figure you out sometimes. "Do you have a safe word in mind?" Tony asks. He's still tipping Steve's face up with one hand, but the other has fallen away from the back of Steve's neck and is balled into a white-knuckled fist resting on his thigh. He's still very still, but Steve can almost feel him thrumming with energy. "No," Steve says uncertainly. He wants to ask what Tony is planning, at the same time that he doesn't want to know. He wonders if this kind of duality is the norm. How about Quark? It's short, easy to remember, and I can't imagine ever using it in a conversation with you. There's a hint of a sneer in Tony's voice when he says it that makes it sting a little. Then something passes over Tony's face. It's quick, and Steve can't be sure, but he thinks it's regret. And Tony says, quietly, "You can still opt out of this, Steve." Tony hasn't ever used Steve's first name before. He tries to come up with some sort of response, but Tony is talking again before he gets the chance. "It doesn't have to be this way. We can just fuck. You can just let me boss you around a little. It doesn't have to get as complex as I could make it." Tony's face and voice are both very serious. "You don't know how complex that really is." Steve waits until he's sure Tony is done talking, and then says, "How many times are you going to fuck me?" His face blazes, and he ignores it. "If I just let you boss me around a little." Tony leans back in his chair, momentarily obviously surprised. Steve thinks it's an interesting look on his face, if only because it's unusual. "You don't know," Steve says, "but probably not that many. You can boss anyone around a little." Tony's expression folds into something a little sharp-edged, but he's regarding Steve with interest, with focus. "I want to do things I don't know about. I want you to do them to me. I don't care that I'll eventually be more or less sexually programmed to enjoy what you enjoy. I don't have a lot of options, Tony. I can't go out and find someone else to teach me. The security is a nightmare, and the subject is one I never want to discuss with the U.S. Army or SHIELD. I trust your discretion. Not for you, because you probably don't care who knows things about you, but for me. I can't risk anyone but you." Tony actually smirks a little. "So, are you saying that you're taking advantage of me, Captain?" "I'm telling you that you are the only one I'd let take advantage of me," Steve says, with as much dignity as he can muster. "If you don't want to, or can't, we can fuck until you lose interest. If that's the case, let me know, because I'm going to need to think a little to back away from the possibilities, I guess, to accept that I can't ever know." Tony regards him seriously. "You've given this a lot of thought." His tone is even, but he still manages to sound as though he's faintly surprised. Steve resists the urge to shake him. "Of course I have," he says exasperatedly. "Why would that surprise you?" "Because you didn't do the reading," Tony says bluntly. "Because my ignorance, in this case, is part of the attraction. That doesn't mean I haven't thought about it, Tony." Steve stops to sigh. "The fact that you think I haven't thought it through probably says more about you and the people you do this with than it does about me." "You were a virgin," Tony notes, as though for the record. "But I wasn't an idiot," Steve says. "At no point was I unaware of what I was allowing. The fact that I was a virgin is probably less significant to the situation than the fact that I'm also a tactical expert and well above average at strategy. You were willing to bribe me, but we both know that's only what it looked like, not what actually happened. I allowed you that illusion because I needed you to be willing to work with me, and because you're attractive and made me an offer that physically affected me. If the idea of what you wanted hadn't done it for me, I would have tried another approach. But it did, and it was the idea of it. It was that it would be like being taken advantage of without actually being taken advantage of. He gives that a moment and then adds, Tony, keeping his voice low and unthreatening. I'm an expert at hand-to-hand combat. He taps at a ribbon that has four bars pinned to it. You literally can't make me do anything I don't want to do. Tony considers Steve's ribbons. So, you did, in fact, take advantage of me, Tony says, a little condescending, but he's smiling. Did you get what you wanted? Steve asks. Oh, yes, Tony says, the smile turning a little smirky. Then, at best, neither of us took advantage, and at worst, we both did. Steve leans a little, so his chest is touching Tony's knees. Tony watches him, hawk-like, but doesn't pull away. My security clearance is so high that I have access to all of the information the government has collectively compiled regarding the Iron Man technology. Tony opens his mouth, but Steve doesn't pause. This is not a threat. It is a fact, and I'm mentioning it for a specific reason. You have it in your head that I'm decorative, as far as my position as liaison goes. I'm trying to tell you that I'm not. I'm not as important as you are. But I'm important, and at no time can it come out that I experimented with kinky homosexual sex. It would be a catastrophe, and I know you can't see quite how, but I am asking you to believe me, because I haven't lied to you about anything. Not what I want, not what the government wants, not anything. Based on that, you are my only option for this. If you aren't, I don't think that would matter. I want you because of the way you treated me, and I have a hard time believing that I'm going to find your exact blend of mannerisms anywhere else, even if I did try. I need you to tell me that I can have this, or tell me that I can't. If it's a no, I can handle that, Tony, but I need a firm answer. Tony presses his knee more firmly against Steve's chest. Steve wants to let his neck go loose and press his forehead to Tony's thigh, but doesn't. I will absolutely give you an answer, if you'll answer a question for me first, as honestly as you possibly can. Tony's tone is deeply serious. Of course I will, Steve says, because of course he will. What you said, Tony begins. What you said when I told you what to say wasn't what I had scripted, for lack of a better word. I expected you to repeat what I told you to say, more or less verbatim, but you didn't. No, Steve agrees, cocking his head a little. He's not sure why it's significant, but he's curious to know why Tony thinks it is. Was that for me or for you? Tony asks. Steve blinks uncertainly, and Tony expounds. I said, tell me that you want me to use your ass until I'm done with it. Tell me you'll take it all from me. Tell me you want to feel me come inside you. But what you said was, fuck me, fuck me, fuck my cherry ass. Do it until I can't take anymore. Use me. Do it harder. Make me take it. Come inside me while I'm helpless and can't stop you. Tony's voice is almost without inflection, but his gaze is impossible to look away from, even though Steve's face feels like it's on fire. The question is, did you say what you thought I wanted to hear, or did you say what you meant? Steve would like to hedge a little, and can't bring himself to do it. He resigns himself to continuing to blush for the immediate future, and tells Tony, both. I wanted to say the things you wanted me to say, and I did, but I wanted to say the other things too. So it all got mixed together. So you intended to repeat what I wanted you to say, and when you opened your mouth, you didn't. You didn't know what you were saying. You were just saying what was right at the top of your mind. Yes? Tony's gaze is like bullets now. Yes, Steve says, blushing, wishing he didn't have the mixture of his coloration and his hair trigger blush reflex. He can't quite keep himself from asking, why is that important? Tony tips Steve's chin up a little further, thumb sliding down the slope of his jaw. Because it means you were responding to my needs at the same time that you were articulating your own. It means that you were feeling submissive enough to me to deliberately hit all the high points that I asked for, but that you were also strong enough to exhibit things that you wanted for yourself, all without having any idea what being in submissive headspace really means at all. Tony smiles at him, maybe the warmest of the smiles Steve has seen from him. It makes his eyes so bright that they seem almost amber. Something twists and turns over in Steve's chest, and his cock rises back up to full mast. Tony's answer is plain on his face. Steve waits for it anyway, because he really does need a firm verbal answer. I'll want more of your time than I've gotten so far, Tony says. Steve recognizes that as a warning and a request, and merely nods. You will tell me at once if we ever start to do something you hate or really fear. Tony waits for Steve to nod again. Some fear is good. You like it like that. But if it feels bad or wrong, you don't keep doing it because you think I want it. I don't want anything that makes you feel that way. I cannot stress this point enough, Captain. You will never decide to suffer through something. Okay, Steve says, and puts his hand on Tony's thigh. Okay, Tony, I get it. Some fear is good. Some pain is probably good. Some things that you say that make me feel... He has to pause and grope for a word that conveys what he's trying to say, aware of Tony watching him frankly the whole time. Dirty, he finally decides. Those things are okay, but if I'm in physical or mental distress, if I feel bad, I will tell you as soon as I become aware of it. Okay? Okay, Tony says. Your safe word is quark. You'll remember? I don't forget things, Steve says. I'll remember. If you want to use it, we both stop what we're doing and break down the situation to see where it went wrong so that we don't make the same mistake repeatedly. Okay, Steve agrees, and wonders if there is more to this lecture. He shifts around a little and bumps his cock up against Tony's calf. Tony snorts. Under those conditions, I would be happy to teach you everything you want to know about kinky gay sex. Steve blushes and says, Can you teach me how to control my blush reflex? If I could, I wouldn't, Tony says, smirking. Every time you blush is so hot that I worry I'm losing brain cells. It makes you practically irresistible. Predictably, Steve continues to blush. He wishes he could think of a good tactic for making this into sex now. His relative ignorance couldn't possibly be more embarrassing than his hot face.